tuned in to the Community Cats Podcast. Ready? Let's go.
Welcome to the Community Cats Podcast. I am your host, Stacey LeBaron. I've been involved helping homeless cats for over 30 years with the Merrimack River Feline Rescue Society. The goal of this podcast is to expose you to amazing people who are improving the lives of cats. I hope these interviews will help you learn how you can turn your passion for cats into action. And today we're speaking with Dr. Maggie Placer, who joined Every Cat Health Foundation in January of 2024. She graduated from Louisiana State University in 2009 and Purdue University College of Veterinary Medicine in 2014. Following graduation, she participated in an American Board of Veterinary Practitioners feline practice residency in the Woodlands in Texas. And she's also worked in Indiana, Illinois, Louisiana, and Texas, primarily in small animal and feline-only practices. She's a published author, her most recent publication being in the Journal of Feline Medicine and Surgery Open Reports. Dr. Placer currently owns and operates an in-home small animal practice and does relief work in small animal, feline, and high-volume spay-neuter practices in Louisiana and Texas. We also have a second guest with us today, Vicki Fisher, who is the immediate past president of the Every Cat Health Foundation. An original crazy old cat lady, Vicki has had a lifelong love of cats and bred and showed Maine Coon cats for more than 20 years. Vicki is the immediate past president of TICA, the International Cat Association, and recently retired approved all-breed cat judge and ring instructor. She enjoys meeting cat lovers all over the world and finds that though spoken language may be different, cat language is universal. Having initially enjoyed the board of Every Cat Health Foundation, formerly the WIN Feline Foundation, over 10 years ago, Vicki first served as the foundation's treasurer and currently is honored to continuing representing the foundation as its immediate past president. Every Cat Health Foundation is a nonprofit organization established in 1968. And is the only worldwide organization to exclusively fund and support studies to improve cat health. Prior to retiring to become a full-time volunteer, Vicki enjoyed a career as a certified public accountant, secretary of the New Mexico Taxation and Revenue Department, Bernalillo County Manager, deputy chief administrative officer for the city of Albuquerque, and held corporate finance positions as a vice president of finance. Vicki and her husband, Larry, discovered New Mexico in 1970 and have lived in Albuquerque, Corrales area for 54 of their 55 years together. They share their home with their three Maine Coon cats, CJ, Pesky, and Floyd. Dr. Maggie, I'm going to welcome you to the show first.
Thank you. Very happy to be here. Appreciate it.
So, Dr. Maggie, first and foremost, how did you get to be passionate about cats?
I would say I always have been. I don't know when it started. My first cat, Callie, was my best friend, a calico, yes. And it was naturally in me to, when I saw a cat outside, take the time, the patience to be my friend. So I've always been drawn to them and the challenge of winning them over, if you will.
And Vicki, how did you get to be passionate about cats?
Actually, my story is a lot like Maggie's. I've always been an animal lover. So I love dogs. I love cats. I love birds, all sorts of things. But there is just an intrigue about cats. And I find their personality fun and challenging. And I don't know. I just love them.
Well, and you, it sounds like you, Vicki, have kind of been full spectrum. I've been in the rescue world. I've been in the trap, neuter, return world. I've been in the spay, neuter world. But it sounds like you're very aware of these issues, but you've also been in a cat fancier's world. What's it like living in sort of both? Are they both separate spheres or are they in one? Are we in one big unified group?
You know what? I think they're in one big unified group, whether everybody believes that or not. Because actually, I do head up a Friends of the City Animal Shelter also. So I do spend a lot of time with rescue people and shelter people and what have you. And we actually all are for the same thing.
And so from that standpoint, when you say we are for the same thing, what does that mean?
It means that we all care about cats and we want the very best for them. We want loving homes. We want the best care, the best treatment. So yeah, we're all after that.
Dr. Maggie, as a veterinarian down in the South, Louisiana, Texas, et cetera, what's life like for community cats, and what's life for you as a high quality, high volume spay neuter veterinarian in that part of the country?
Yeah, I think it's work that'll always be needed to be done. There's a lot of breeding going on down here. It's a year-round thing. So grateful for the support of other states because we do have year-round problems. Sometimes we can ship some animals for help in other states. But yes, definitely our shelters, our rescues need support because it's a high volume issue, probably more so than the rest of the country.
Just because I'm a total high volume, high quality spay neuter nut, I'm going to ask you, so you are mobile. Do you go to different facilities or are you a mobile vehicle vet?
Yeah, so I've kind of just started. I worked in kind of brick and mortar practices the past 10 years, cat clinics, small dogs, small animal clinics. And I kind of saw a need for particularly cats, a lot of them doing better at home, or owners who themselves had transportation issues are also offering humane euthanasia at home. So that's kind of, so it's basically just me in an SUV filling those needs where I can, sending them to the rescues or the vet clinics as I could. So once I've ended up back home where I'm from, Lafayette, Louisiana, I've learned what to send where, when to work with the rescues, how to utilize the shelters. And so kind of I play the in-between.
Vicky, I'm going to ask you a question since you've had such a long experience with the Every Cat Health Foundation. And I am still more familiar with the WIN Feline Foundation. So we still have to learn that we are now Every Cat Health Foundation. You've talked a little bit about the history in your bio, but what is this group and what do they do for community cats?
We actually changed our name to Every Cat Health Foundation only about 3 years or so ago because we found that it was so descriptive of what we do. And we tell folks that we fund feline health research exclusively and that it impacts every cat, including community cats. Even things like the vaccines, early spay neuter, for instance, which has been a big game changer in the rescue and shelter world. That research was funded by us. So we impact the health of every cat. It doesn't matter whether it's a pedigree cat or just a household pet cat in the house, community cats, shelter cats, and cats all over the world. So the issues with cats are pretty general and apply to each and every one.
So I know we're going to try and devote some time today to talk about FIP and some of the research that has been going on there. But I'm going to also ask Vicky a follow-up question on the changing times for cats and their health. Very excited to have the conversation about FIP. I feel like maybe 5-7 years ago, maybe we were talking more about feline leukemia. And then maybe 10 years ago, we were talking more about FIV. Have you seen this evolution of the different sort of disease cycles where maybe we're not talking about FIV as much as we used to? Or do you still feel like FIV, feline leukemia, FIP, they're all still on the hot list?
Well, I don't know. This is probably something Maggie would want to comment on. But you know, that research that we talked about, in fact, has given us good options for many of those diseases. So what has come forward are the things that we can now, that we haven't been able to tackle, that we can now. And we actually funded FIP research for probably 50 years, and it's taken that long for there to become a breakthrough that has actually led to a cure. And there's still just a lot of research that's left in that area. But again, I think the basic thing is, and this for sure, is that cats have finally come into their own. For so many years, cats have been second-class citizens. And the interest and the money and the research in small animal health was concentrated in dogs. And so all vets had was the notion that cats were little dogs because the health research that they had, the treatments they had, the diagnostics were related to dogs. But now, thanks to ICANN has cheeseburger and the internet and cat memes, people have said, you know what? Cats are valuable too. They're great companion animals. And we need to get serious about finding the types of diseases that are specific to cats, the treatments, the nutrition, and everything. So it's been great. It's been wonderful. We love to see the impact now of interest in cats.
Dr. Maggie, what are your thoughts on this topic?
Yeah, it's a great question. When I was in vet school, so I graduated in 2014, I was part of a study in Chicago to see kind of the longevity of FIV cats in homes there. So whereas that used to be a more heavy diagnosis, we're seeing that they could live nice, long lives. There was a study supported by probably Wynn at that time, but how to better handle FELV testing and diagnosis in shelters. So we have this disease, what to do when in a practical setting, that's something that we've contributed to. And then FIP, unfortunately, doesn't care where the cat came from or where it lives. And so it's something that, as we were going to talk about the outbreak in Cyprus, this cat's being affected. We want to help or do everything we can to help them there. And from helping there, extrapolate to maybe quicker testing, more affordable testing, advance further where we are. And I did want to mention as well, I was speaking with our current president who has more experience as a veterinarian, you could say, maybe some years on me as well. But he was telling me when he was practicing, he had to counsel owners through, is FIP contagious? So I am grateful that I have been able to piggyback on that research and came out with a little bit more of a head start to avoid a panic. So that would only be possible with cat-specific research. So in working in cat-only practices, when I encounter dogs, which I also do love, I treat them like big cats. So I'm kind of flipping that around. So I really think that, yeah, it takes a focus on cat issues to help cats.
Vicky, let's start jumping in and talk about the FIP research that was funded by the foundation. Where did this proposal come from and how did the foundation approve it? And what was the origin story? And then maybe Dr. Maggie can fill us in on more of the details.
FIP has, for those who have had the experience of dealing with cats and FIP, it's pretty heartbreaking and has always been one of those things that we just knew there had to be some way to either cure or test or prevent or what have you. And fortunately, probably some 40, 50 years ago, a gentleman, a doctor by the name of Niels Peterson from University of California, Davis, took this on as what became somewhat of a lifelong challenge. And since it was a disease that was so heartbreaking, and when he came to us with the first proposal to actually to study the disease, we hopped on that. And I think he will tell you that he started out, because I don't quite remember that far back, but he started out looking for a vaccine, which he wasn't able to produce. And then he looked for a test, which didn't. And he never, the last thing in the world he ever thought would happen would be actually that he would discover a cure. So now we're going backwards. Now we've got the cure. We want to refine that. We want to go back to the tests. We want to go back to the vaccines and hopefully backtrack. But it has been a labor of love for him and commitment to cats for many years. And it's been obviously one of our passions is first Wynn and then every cat. The most recent thing that Maggie is best suited to talk about is that there was less than a year ago, I believe, or about a year ago, an unusual amount of cases of FIP on the island of Cyprus. And Cyprus is known for a huge community of cats, community cats. And what folks were finding was that cats were dying of FIP at a pretty unusual rate. And that caused some concern within the research community, within the pet owner and the community cat folks about what was going on. So this little epidemic that we became aware of seemed like something that we really needed to look at and study, especially since we had and cats had the attention of researchers that were interested in this particular topic for cats from all over the world. And so basically what we're doing now is working with a consortium of researchers all over the globe that are totally focused on FIP.
All right, Dr. Maggie. So let's get into this study that you've been involved with.
Yeah. So one of the places we're starting off is what's different about this virus. Is it possible that it is indeed spreading from one cat to another without the mutation that we know is required in the form that we're used to? As far as the different treatments, we want to help these cats as best we can. So it becomes what dose? We know what drugs work well. What dose works better for what form or symptoms, if you will? What's the most cost effective? So we want to help these. We want to learn all we can, but the practicality of it is how do we help these people do the most good for the most cats? So it almost becomes something that I hope can be translatable to the general practitioner, the shelter, not always just at an academic level. So what's different about it? How can we use what we know to help them? And because we are trying to help a lot of cats quickly, how can we streamline testing, prevent this from going anywhere else? And as many of us know, coronaviruses affect other species, including humans. So translational medicine, I guess you could call it, but kind of species helping species, and that in understanding this coronavirus better, how can that help other species? Help cats, of course, but that's why there's a lot of interest beyond cat lovers. But that's our focus, is to learn what we can from the situation, help there, and then expand on what we learn.
Do you want to start or grow a TNR movement in your community? Whether you're just getting started or looking to take your advocacy to the next level, our upcoming webinar might be just what you need. Join Neighborhood Cats on Saturday, February 15th from 2 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time for a virtual workshop, From the Backyard to the Front Page, Building a TNR Movement, a powerful session on how grassroots efforts can turn into real, lasting change for community cats. Learn from experts who've led successful TNR programs that not only save lives, but also gain public support and media attention. Find out how to mobilize your community and build grassroots support for TNR. Discover strategies for engaging local media and getting your TNR efforts the attention they deserve. Learn how to inspire volunteers and create a sustainable team for your TNR program. Get tips for scaling up your efforts to make a broader impact on community cat populations. And check out real-life examples from leaders who've successfully built TNR movements. You'll walk away with the strategies you need to organize, inspire, and make an impact. Plus, when you pass a brief test, you'll receive a certificate of completion to recognize your expertise. Registration is just $10, and you'll get access to a replay if you can't stay for the whole event. Don't miss this chance to become a leader in the TNR movement. Sign up now at communitycatspodcast.com. That's communitycatspodcast.com. Trap cats, change minds.
Are you a proud cat parent looking for the perfect, affordable health care for your kitty? Well, look no further than the Community Cat Clinic, conveniently located in Woodstock, Georgia, just north of Atlanta and not too far from the Tennessee and South Carolina borders. The health and happiness of all cats are the top priorities at this feline-only hospital. From preventative care, spay, neuter, and vaccines, to specialized and innovative treatments like full mouth dental, ultrasound, radio, iodine therapy, emergency blockage cases, they've got your cat's well-being covered. For the TNR community and local shelters, they offer easy-to-access, low-cost spay-neuter services and volume appointments. So if you want to do a large TNR project, this is the clinic you want to go to. It's worth the extra trip. Appointments are available most days. Check out the Community Cat Clinic online at communitycatclinic.com or visit them in person at the Walmart Shopping Center at the Shops of Trichem on Highway 92 at Trichem Road in Woodstock, Georgia. More purr, less price. Want an easy grant opportunity for your animal organization? Maddie's Fund is giving away a $3,000 grant each month to one lucky Maddie's Pet Forum member. You'll automatically be entered to win each month when you start a new discussion, reply to a new post, or upload a new library resource. Learn more at forum.maddiesfund.org today.
So I'm going to get my little back of the napkin calculator here. So how many cats are on Cyprus?
Well, I don't know, a lot. And interestingly enough, there are a number of sanctuaries for cats on Cyprus. And not surprisingly, some of those happen to be monasteries, which is where humans and cats kind of came together many zillions of years ago as the rodent control in monasteries. So a lot of shelters there, a lot of community cats. I don't know, but I know that's a very large percentage relative to other places.
And then, so how many cats are you hoping to assist in this study?
Well, I guess I would say cats all over the world, frankly.
But in the sample size, I mean, so sample in Cyprus, is it, are you 100 cats, 1,000 cats? I mean, how many are you hoping to reach through this study?
I guess I would like to say we help 100% of them. That's kind of an easy out. But there was some kind of conflicting information as to how many cats were affected at first. I mean, we definitely, easy to say hundreds, likely thousands. So part of that comes from maybe different diagnostic approaches. So because it's not easy to diagnose, not every monastery cat can get a biopsy to confirm. So one of the things we were doing is kind of streamlining, okay, everybody, if, as best as we can, let's get on board with how do we diagnose and kind of just unify things. So I think it's easy to say thousands of cats have been affected, and then we're hoping to help as many as we can.
So I would assume that there are some that are carriers that don't become symptomatic, and then there are others. There's my FIP education is pretty 90s, I will put it. So there's the wet form, there's the dry form, there's the I don't know form. And then, so when in doubt, veterinary, oh, it's got to be FIP. But it was much more of a worry when you were dealing with hoarding situations, with inbreeding situations. So our attack in Newburyport was if we ever had a situation out in an outdoor colony or a hoarding situation where there was some sense that we had some FIP there, we just went like crazy and we made sure everybody got spayed and neutered. We made sure that everybody was as supported nutritionally as possible, vaccinated. We wanted to do everything possible to reduce the colony down. And we also would make aware to our potential adopters, if we had kittens from that group, that they may be what we would call immune compromised because of the level of inbreeding. So we felt that was a very at-risk, vulnerable population. And we decided to put that sort of at the top of our urgency level rather than going, oh, we'll do two or three this month and we'll do two or three next month. We really tried to. So I was thinking you do a heat map in Cyprus of where those FIP spots are. We do this in Massachusetts with a rabies outbreak. And you then just kind of do as much supportive care or population reduction as you can in those areas to reduce the spread of disease. Is that something that folks are thinking about, Dr. Maggie?
Yeah, you make a good point in that FIP, a lot of things have changed, but some things haven't changed in decades. In that, just a quick little summary is a lot of cats are exposed and have feline coronavirus. Something within certain cats, and we're not certain what, causes it to mutate to the form of FIP. So to your point of limiting the number of cats, more cats together or more stressed cats, that could be a factor in what's going on. So we still don't know why all three of us here could be exposed to the feline coronavirus. Why does it mutate to FIP in me? Could this intense study in Cyprus help us to better understand that? That's speaking about the strains that we have always dealt with. This new one, there is the question, why is it possibly spreading cat to cat like we don't think happens in the strains we currently understand? Does that kind of make sense? So the point being, it's always better to keep them. It's that basic feline coronavirus that I mentioned that a lot of cats are exposed to maybe causes some stomach upset, but really doesn't cause disease. It's very hard to eradicate. So cleaning and things are always good. Decreasing the amount of cats together is always good. Less stress on cats is always good. But the way we understand FIP before this Cyprus situation is that it's not contagious, if you will. It takes something unique in the cat.
All right. Vicky, any other comments from you on that?
No, I think Maggie's pretty well covered it. We could go on probably for hours. So,
well, I'm going to just share with you some of the anxiety and stress that I have had to process through over the last 30 years being involved in cat rescue and running a cat adoption center. And I can't tell you how many conversations I've had about FIP and FIP in shelters, and cat comes down with FIP or cat gets adopted and it gets diagnosed with FIP. And it's like, you have to shut down your whole facility and like the world is falling apart and all of that. And it's like, no, take a breath. And we've had these alarms go off with feline leukemia too. And the alarms go off with ringworm too. And so we have all of this, like, we need to be in a sterile environment. And we know a sterile environment is not a conducive environment to cat's well-being, for sure. And so we've had to find our mid-level range of providing comfort, hormonal comfort for the cats, as well as protection from disease spread and that kind of thing in a sheltering situation. And a lot of that is called capacity for care and all that kind of stuff, too. And it is interesting because when we're talking about our community cats, they're outside, right? They're running around, they're breathing the fresh air. So it's not like this fake ventilated situation. They're outside. But yet disease does still spread. But I think it has a higher rate of spreading through mating and through fighting rather than sort of casual interactions. At least that's been our approach, really focusing in on the spay neuter and the reducing of the cattle overpopulation situation. Plus kittens, they're not having a great time out there, you know, being born outside and that kind of thing. But Dr. Maggie, I'd like to know your thoughts on having cats outdoors. Let's think a dream world. Every cat in a colony is spayed or neutered. It's ear tipped beautifully. It's got its rabies vaccine. So let's call it the utopian community cat colony is out there. Do you feel that there are risks to any of those cats having disease more so than the do nothing option?
Sure. So I think there'd be a lot of argument and research for the benefit of cats having some access to some outdoors. So catio, you can kind of cut that apart, but not community cats don't really have access to a catio one day in this maybe magical world. Yes. But to your point of when transmission requires a bite or saliva, hopefully that's decreased by the neutering and spaying situation. I would love for them to have microchips too, but that's just me dreaming. So the idea when we think of that once again, that basic coronavirus that doesn't always cause a problem, because that spread through feces, that's hard outside. It's in the dirt. It's around cats and things. So yes, less violence between cats is great, which the fixing will help. But I do think that, yeah, of course, there's the risks of injury with the outdoors, but I think there's an argument to be said or something to be said for the benefit of that kind of situation. We're not trying to have cats that don't have homes, but I think that knowing more about, once again, FIP or how things are spread, we may be able to learn more from the poop of those cats to say, hey, this one could thrive outside, or this one has a little GI biome that is truly immune compromised. So then we make maybe a push. This one shouldn't be released. If you know, it helped. I guess my goal would always be less invasive, also less expensive testing that allows us to learn what we can from these guys and help them in a practical way that could be benefit a larger population.
Mentioned something, Dr. Maggie, that really got my interest. I know this is prevalent in human medicine. So are we looking for signs of disease like in cat stool? Like, is there anything with FIP in the gut microbiome analysis and trying to figure out if there's something different in a cat's one GI tract versus the other, like I think what we're doing in the human medicine field?
So you're right. I have been a part of a fecal transplant endosomal animal patient. So and while it sounds advanced, I mean, it's almost like a reverse enema. I hope your clients are okay, your fans are okay with this, are also capsules that contain a healthier form of the biome. So I think just growing up, the whole you are what you eat, or the fact that a lot of your lymphatic or your immune system lines your gut, there's a lot to be learned there. We currently have a study we funded in the spring looking at the benefit of a healthier microbiome for kidney disease. So I think that, yes, a lot can be learned from there. And then especially in a virus that we know is transmitted that way, could we on the front end give these community cats something that set them up for better success, or who couldn't benefit from a stronger immune system? So I think that, I don't see why not. And I think they volunteer those samples quite readily. So why not the product?
Well, and I think it's actually really intriguing because I've been thinking as we embark on 2025, trying to launch different solutions for our listeners to really empower them to be able to improve the lives of the cats. And really, let's look at what we're feeding our community cats out there, how we're feeding them, and what symbolizes, we have all the charts, what's a healthy body type for cats and that kind of thing. And so, but how do we really impress that by doing this, by feeding the cats in a short space of time, maybe less dry, more wet, trying to focus on some priorities to help with the body coat, the tone, the overall health and wellness. And that will really limit the amount of chronic disease that those cats are going to be faced with 10 years down the line. And so what are the things, what's the low-hanging fruit that we still haven't dealt with when we're maintaining and caring for the cats that we all love that are out there in the community, but we need to kind of hold back and not give them the junk food, maybe that's out there, but also ensuring that everybody's getting a bite, right? And there's a whole hierarchy out there too. But as our colonies get smaller or our communities get smaller, we can be even more careful about how they're being treated. And at the end of the game, I do think we want our community cat colony size to be reduced to a manageable and sustainable level. I don't know a lot of people who like the responsibility of caring for several hundred cats at a variety of feeding locations, and that's done pretty frequently. We want those cats to age out. In Newburyport, we had 300 cats at 14 feeding stations. Now we have none, zero, absolutely zero. So it can be done. They can age out. You can have a community without those kinds of community cats, but it takes monitoring, care, a lot of work. But hey, what is it? 55% of the population feeds cats that they don't know who owns them, right? So we are feeding them anyway. We might as well just acknowledge it and move on and accept it and work together. So Vicky, I want to just circle back before we close out and just ask you, if folks are interested in finding out more about the work of the foundation, where would they go?
Ooh, that's easy. Our website is everycat.org. Everycat.org, very easy. And I will say this, that there are, for those that are interested in the deep dive of research, we do have a pretty extensive library of research and a very complete library of the research that we have funded. We also partner quite a lot with the American Association of Feline Practitioners. A lot of information on their website also, a lot of their treatment guidelines, and I'll mention this relative to FIP, is that we in fact co-authored diagnosis guidelines for FIP that are published both on our website and on the American Association of Feline Practitioners. Lots and lots of information there. We also, of course, have a social media presence, like everybody. We have a wonderful Facebook, Instagram accounts. Encourage folks to go to our website and sign up for our monthly e-newsletter. It's free. And that way folks can keep up with some of the research that's going on, new things that are coming out, tips and trials. We oftentimes will have some of our researchers say, hey, we're ready to do a trial. We need cats. We need samples. We need swabs, et cetera. And so there's opportunities for people to chip in and help with research. So we're pretty easy to find, everycat.org. And AAFP is catvets.org. So anyway, very easy to find. We appreciate attention. We appreciate help towards the benefit of cats, for sure.
And Dr. Maggie, is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners before we close out today?
Well, I was going to mention to what you were saying, you had me thinking on the concept of One Health. You know, we need pediatricians and nutritionists to, you know, how can we give these animals the best start? So I think there's a lot more conversations to be had. And also, I did want to mention, we are part of a study with the Dumb Friends League in Denver. It's a cat den study. So the idea is when cats are brought in, if they're housed in this little kind of den where it's still clean and things, but they maintain almost the smell that they're comfortable with. The point of the study is to see, do these cats have less occurrence of upper respiratory infections? Therefore, are they healthier and get homes quicker? So we are encouraged by how we can make changes like that have a real outcome of getting cats into homes.
Excellent. Well, I want to thank you both for joining us today as guests on the Community Cats podcast, and I hope we'll have you on the show in the future.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's it for this week. Please head over to Apple Podcasts and leave a review. We love to hear what you think, and a 5-star review really helps others find the show. You can also join the conversation with listeners, cat caretakers, and me on Facebook and Instagram. And don't forget to hit follow or subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, YouTube, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts so you don't miss a single show. Thanks for listening, and thank you for everything that you do to help create a safe and healthy world for cats.